Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Over the last several months, I have been investigating into the whole issue of what is known as the web of debt. We have been using a book called The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown, who's an attorney, to try to understand what is really perceived as the shocking truth about our money system, and of course, ultimately, how we can break free. In short, our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. The Web of Debt is a book that unravels this deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. It then, in a positive vein, explores workable alternatives, one in particular that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It's a very important and ultimately practical presentation of what money is all about, and of course then how to deal with it for our own financial security, for that of the nation, and ultimately the entire globe. At the onset, I'd like to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 other books and scores of articles in the area of debt. I highly recommend that you actually read her book, The Web of Debt. You can also go to her website by the same name, and you can review all of the shows that we have produced for debt-related issues at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, and specifically Life and Debt Web. The last thing we talked about in the prior show was Wright Patman and how he exposed the money machine. If Wright Patman had been a character in The Wizard of Oz, he would probably have been Dorothy's feisty dog, Toto, who nipped fearlessly at the Wicked Witch's heels, saved his mistress by leaping boldly across a closing drawbridge, and exposed the man behind the curtain, pretending to be a great and powerful wizard. Patman spent nearly 50 years barking at the wicked institutions he thought were out to get the farmers and small businesses of his Texas constituency. They included big businesses, chain stores, tax-exempt foundations, and most wicked of all, the Federal Reserve Board, whose restrictive monetary policies he felt placed the interests of Wall Street above those of Main Street. Sounds very familiar these days, like Elizabeth Warren. Patman was first elected to Congress in 1928 and was reelected 24 times. He served as chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee from 1963 to 1975. and in Congress until his death in 1976. He was called an economic populist. He inspired a major protest march on Washington in 1932, the March of Unemployed World War I Veterans, petitioning for the bonus bill, which he wrote. Patman was the first to call for the investigation not only of the Penn Central in 1970, but of Watergate. One reviewer described him as a cranky eccentric out of place in the increasingly slick and polished world of Washington politics. But therein lay his significance. He used his outsider status to force onto the national agenda issues that few politicians cared or dared to raise. In his role as chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, Patman penetrated the official Fed speak to expose what was really going on. After a probing investigation of the Federal Reserve, he charged, quote, "The Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve System has the power to obtain and does obtain the printed money of the United States, the Federal Reserve notes, from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and exchanges these printed notes, which of course are not interest-bearing, for United States government obligations that are interest-bearing. After making the exchange, the interest-bearing obligations are retained by the 12 Federal Reserve banks, and the interest collected annually on these government obligations goes into the funds of the 12 Federal Reserve banks. These funds are expended by the system without an adequate accounting to the Congress." Close quote. Now, the Open Market Committee was the group formed in 1934 to take charge of open market operations, the Fed's buying and selling of government securities. Those are bills, bonds, and notes by which the government borrows money. Then, as now, the Open Market Committee acquired Federal Reserve notes from the Federal Bureau of Engraving and Printing, essentially for the cost of printing them. The average cost today is about 4 cents per bill. In deft card shark fashion, these dollar bills are then swapped for an equivalent stack of notes labeled Treasury securities. Turning Treasury securities, or debt, into money, which are Federal Reserve notes, is called monetizing the debt. The government owes this money back to the Fed, although the Fed has advanced nothing but printed paper to earn it. In a revealing treatise called A Primer on Money, Patman concluded, quote, "The Federal Reserve is a total money-making machine. It can issue money or checks, and it never has a problem of making its checks good because it can obtain the $5 and $10 bills necessary to cover its check simply by asking the Treasury Department's Bureau of Engraving to print them." End quote. This statement was confirmed by Mariner Eccles, then chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, in testimony before the House Banking and Currency Committee in 1935, Eccles acknowledged, quote, "In purchasing offerings of government bonds, the banking system as a whole creates new money, or bank deposits. When the banks buy $1 billion of government bonds, as they are offered, the banks credit the deposit account of the Treasury with $1 billion. They debit their government bond account $1 billion, or they actually create, by bookkeeping entry, $1 billion. Close quote. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. As the economist John Kenneth Galbraith would later comment, "The process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled. The mind is repelled because the process is sleight of hand and so completely foreign to what we have been taught. In a phenomenon called cognitive dissonance, we can read the words and still doubt whether we have read them right. To make sure that we have, then, here is another credible source. In 1993, National Geographic magazine published an article by assistant editor Peter White titled, "Do Banks Really Create Money Out of Thin Air?" White began by observing that 92% of the money supply consists not of bills or coins, but of checkbook and other non-tangible money. To find out where this money comes from, he asked a Federal Reserve official who said that every day the Federal Reserve Bank of New York buys U.S. government securities from major banks and brokerage houses. That's if the Fed wants to expand the money supply. If it wants to contract the money supply, it sells government securities. White wrote, quote, "Say today the Fed buys $100 million in Treasury bills from those big securities dealers who keep a stock of them to trade with the public. When the Fed pays the dealers, $100 million will thereby be added to the country's money supply because the dealers will be credited that amount by their banks, which now have that much more on deposit. But where did the Fed get the $100 million? We created it," a Fed official tells me. He means that anytime the central bank writes a check, so to speak, it creates money. It's money that didn't exist before, he says. Is there any limit on that? No limit. Only the good judgment and the conscience of the responsible Federal Reserve people. And where did they get this vast authority? It was delegated to them in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Based on the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof. Close quote. Andrew Jackson would probably have said vipers and thieves. He stressed that the Constitution gives Congress the power only to coin money, and if coining money means creating money, it gives that power only to Congress. The 10th Amendment provides that powers not delegated to the United States or forbidden to the states are reserved to the states or the people. In 1935, the U.S. Supreme Court held that Congress may not abdicate or transfer to others its legitimate functions. After relentless agitation by Patman's committee, the Fed finally agreed to rebate most of the interest it received on its government bonds to the U.S. Treasury. Congressman Jerry Voorhees, another early Fed watchdog, said that the agreement was a tacit admission that the Fed wasn't entitled to interest. It wasn't entitled to interest because its own money wasn't being lent. Fed apologists today argue that since the interest, or most of it, is now rebated to the government, no net advantage has accrued to the Fed. But that argument overlooks a far greater windfall to the banks that are the Fed's owners and real constituents. The bonds that have been acquired essentially for free become the basis of the Fed's reserves, the phantom money that is advanced many times over by commercial banks in the form of loans. Virtually all money in circulation today can be traced to government debt that has been monetized by the Federal Reserve and the banking system. This money is then multiplied many times over in the form of bank loans. In 2006, M3, which is the broadest measure of the money supply, was nearly $10 trillion, and the Treasury securities held by the Federal Reserve came to about one-tenth that sum. That means that the money supply has expanded by a factor of about 10 for every dollar of federal debt monetized by the Federal Reserve, and all of this monetary expansion consists of loans on which the banks have been paid interest. It is this interest, not the interest paid to the Federal Reserve, that is the real windfall to the banks. This and the fact that the banks now have a money-making machine to back them up whenever they get in trouble with their fractional reserve lending scheme. So we see that the Jekyll Island plan had worked beautifully. The bankers succeeded in creating a secret source of unlimited funds that could be tapped into whenever they were caught short-handed. And to make sure their scheme remained a secret, they concealed this money machine in obscure Fed speak that made the whole subject seem dull and incomprehensible to the uninitiated and was misleading even to people who thought they understood it. In the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, Ed Griffin writes that modern money is a grand illusion conjured by the magicians of finance and politics. The function of the Federal Reserve, he says, is to convert debt into money. It's just that simple. The mechanism may seem complicated at first, but it is simple if one remembers that the process is not intended to be logical, but to confuse and deceive. Now, the process by which the Fed converts debt into money begins after the government's bonds are offered to the public at auction. Griffin writes, quote, "The Fed takes all the government bonds, which the public does not buy, and writes a check to Congress in exchange for them. There is no money to back up this check. These fiat dollars are created on the spot for that purpose. By calling these bonds reserves, the Fed then uses them as the base for creating 9 additional dollars for every dollar created for the bonds themselves. The money created for the bonds is spent by the government, whereas the money created on top of those bonds is the source of all the bank loans made to the nation's businesses and individuals. The result of this process is the same as creating money on a printing press, but the illusion is based on an accounting trick rather than a printing trick." Close quote. The result is the same with this difference. In the minds of most people, printing press money is created by the government. The accounting trick that generates 99% of the U.S. money supply today is the sleight of hand of private banks. The shell game devised by the 17th century goldsmiths, which we talked about quite a lot in the past, is now called fractional reserve banking. The fraction of a bank's outstanding loans that must be held in reserve is called the reserve requirement, and it is set by the Fed. The New York Federal Reserve has now deleted its earlier explanation from its website, but as it explained the money creating process in 2004, quote, "Reserve requirements are computed as percentages of deposits that banks must hold as vault cash or on deposit at a Federal Reserve Bank. As of December 2006, the reserve requirement was 10% on transaction deposits, and there were zero reserves required for time deposits. If the reserve requirement is 10%, for example, a bank that receives $100 deposit may lend out $90 of that deposit. If the borrower then writes a check to someone who deposits the $90, the bank receiving the deposit can lend out $81. As the process continues, the banking system can expand the initial deposit of $100 into a maximum of $1,000 of money, which in the example is 100 plus 90 plus 81 plus 72, 90, and so forth until it actually becomes equivalent to $1,000 based on a $100 deposit. And this is the end of the quote. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the definitions here. It all sounds so reasonable, but when you look very closely at the definitions, a time deposit is a bank deposit that cannot be withdrawn before a date specified at the time of the deposit. A transaction deposit is a term used by the Federal Reserve for checkable deposits, deposits on which checks can be drawn, and other accounts that can be used directly as cash without withdrawal limits or restrictions. Transaction deposits are also called demand deposits. They can be withdrawn on demand at any time without notice. All checking accounts are demand deposits. Some savings accounts require funds to be kept on deposit for a minimum length of time, but most savings accounts are permitted unlimited access to funds, as long as enough money is kept in reserve to satisfy depositors who come for their money. Transaction deposits can be lent many times over. The 90% the bank lends is redeposited, and 90% of that is relent, in a process that repeats about 20 times until the $100 becomes $1,000. But wait a minute. These funds belong to the depositors and must remain available at all times for their own use. How can the money be available to the depositor and lent out at the same time? Well, it can't. The loan money, it seems, is sleight of hand. It is basically counterfeited in the form of loans. This indeed is the case which was substantiated in Modern Money Mechanics, the Chicago Federal Reserve's informative booklet, explaining how fractional reserve lending allows money to expand. It illustrates the whole process with a chart showing that the original deposit, $10,000 in Chicago Fed's example, is not actually lent, but remains in the bank throughout the expansion process. What is lent is an additional sum valued at 90% of the original deposit. Then another sum is lent that is 90% of the second deposit, and so forth, until the total sum generates 10 times the original deposit, or $100,000. The 10% reserve requirement imposed on the banks harkens back to the 17th century goldsmiths who found through trial and error that depositors collectively would not come for more than about 10% of their money at one time. The money could therefore be lent 9 times over without anyone being the wiser. Today, the scheme gets obscured because many banks are involved, but the collective result is the same. When the banks receive $1 million in deposits, they can lend not just $900,000, 90% of the $1 million, but $9 million in computer-generated funds. As we shall see, reserves are being phased out, so the multiple is actually higher than that, but to keep it simple, we'll use that figure. We will take a hypothetical case. You live in a small town with only one bank. You sell your house for $100,000 and deposit the money into your checking account at the bank. The bank then advances 90% of the sum, or $90,000, to Ms. White to buy a house from Mr. Black. The bank proceeds to collect from Ms. White both the interest and the principal on this loan. Assume the prevailing interest rate is 6.25%. Interest at 6.25% on $90,000 over the life of a 30-year mortgage comes to $109,490. Ms. White thus winds up owing $199,490 in principal and interest on the loan, not to you, whose money it allegedly was in the first place, but to the bank. Legally, Ms. White has title to the house, but the bank becomes the effective owner until she pays off her mortgage. That's the first transaction. Now, Mr. Black takes the $90,000 Ms. White paid him for his house and deposits it into his checking account at the town bank. The bank adds $90,000 to its reserve balance at its Federal Reserve Bank and advances 90% of the sum, or $81,000, to Mrs. Green, who wants to buy a house from Mr. Gray. Over 30 years, Mrs. Green owes the bank $81,000 in principal plus $98,541 in interest, or $179,541, and the bank has become the effective owner of another house until the loan is paid off. Continuing, Mr. Gray deposits Mrs. Green's money into his checking account. The process continues until the bank has lent $900,000 on which it collects $900,000 in principal and $985,410 in interest for a total of $1,885,410. The bank has thus created $900,000 out of thin air and has acquired effective ownership of a string of houses, at least temporarily, all from an initial $100,000 deposit. And it is owed $985,410 in interest on this loan. The $900,000 principal is extinguished by an entry on the credit side of the ledger when the loans are paid off, but the other half of this conjured $2 million, the interest, remains solidly in the coffers of the bank. And if any of the borrowers should default on their loans, the bank becomes the owner of the mortgaged property too. Just as an aside, in principle and common practice, you probably wouldn't keep $100,000 in a checking account that paid no interest. You would invest it somewhere. But when the bank makes loans based on its collective checking account deposits, the result's the same. The bank keeps the interest and pays out very little interest on savings deposits. But now, instead of that example with houses, let's try it with $100 million in treasury bills bought by the Fed in a single day, which was the National Geographic example, using $100 million in book entry money created out of thin air. At a reserve requirement of 10%, $100 million can generate $900 million in loans. If the interest rate on those loans is just 5%, the $900 million will return $45 million the first year in interest to the banks that wrote the loans. At compound interest over time, then $100 million investment in money created out of thin air is doubled about every 2 years. In short, this is all not believable to the average person, even including your average congressman. The Fed reports that 95% of its profits are now returned to the U.S. Treasury. A lot of people hear that. But a review of its balance sheet, which is available on the internet, shows that it reports as profits only the interest received from the federal securities it holds as reserves. No mention is made of the much greater windfall afforded to the banks that are the Fed's corporate owners, which use the securities as the reserves that get multiplied many times over in the form of loans. The Federal Reserve maintains that it is now audited every year by Price Waterhouse and the Government Accounting Office, GAO, an arm of Congress, but some functions remain off limits to GAO, including its transactions with foreign central banks and its open market operations, the operations by which it creates money with accounting entities. Thus, the Fed's most important and most highly suspect functions remain beyond public scrutiny. Wright Patman proposed cleaning up the books by abolishing the Open Market Committee and nationalizing the Federal Reserve, reclaiming it as a truly federal agency under the auspices of Congress. The dollars the Fed created would then be government dollars, issued debt-free without increasing the debt burden of the country. Jerry Voorhees also advocated skipping the middleman and letting the government issue its own money. Neither proposal, however, was passed by Congress. Rather, Patman was removed as head of the House Banking and Currency Committee after holding that position for 12 years, and Voorhees lost the next California congressional election to Richard Nixon after being targeted by an aggressive smear campaign financed by the American Bankers Association. And we will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.